the state Supreme Court overturns the light sentence of a teacher who raped a student. Good evening, I'm Connor Valentine.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
The father of a slain German exchange student arrives in Missoula and will have more reaction to that shooting. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with Princeton professor and author Robert P. George about religious freedom and his opposition to gay marriage. The Montana Supreme Court today overturned a one-month sentence that was widely condemned as too lenient for a former high school teacher convicted of raping a 14-year-old student. The court ordered a new judge to resentence defendant Stacy Dean Rambold, who has been free since completing the previous term last fall. The High Court's decision cited in part the actions of District Judge G. Todd Baugh of Billings, who suggested the young victim shared responsibility for her rape because she had some control over the situation. Baugh sparked outrage when he commented that victim Charisse Morales was, quote, older than her chronological age. The teenager committed suicide in 2010 before Rambold went to trial. State prosecutors said Rambold should have received a minimum of 2 years under state law. Baugh relied on a different section of the same statute when he gave the defendant 15 years with all but 31 days suspended and a one-day credit for time served. Rambold was required to register as a sex offender and was to remain on probation through 2028. The state president of the Montana National Organization for Women, Marion Bradley, says she's very encouraged by today's decision.
When we speak out as people in this county, state, nation, we have a voice, and our Supreme Court listened to the voice, and they listened to what we had to say, and they saw value in what we had to say, and that just shows that no one judge is beyond reproach. You know, he did a bad sentence, and that sentence should have been reversed in some manner.
A disciplinary complaint against Baugh from the Judicial Standards Commission is pending with the state Supreme Court. Justices said that will be dealt with separately. That complaint was filed by Montana Now and Pennsylvania Now. Bradley says the outcome of that complaint is still relevant, even though Baugh has said he will not run for another term.
We took a victory out of the fact that the Standards Commission saw our point of view and decided that he had some violations and sent it to the Supreme Court. I think the other piece that's so important is he may have had all these years on the bench, but we need to send a clear message to other judges in this state, in this country, that we are watching. And we will hold them accountable for their bad choices.
The disciplinary complaint pending before the High Court would have Baugh removed from the bench for alleged bias.
And in other news from around the state, a German consulate spokeswoman says the father of a 17-year-old exchange student who was shot and killed by a homeowner has arrived in Montana. Spokeswoman Julia Reinhardt says Chalal Didi and a family friend arrived yesterday from Germany to recover the body of Diren Didi. She says a consulate official from San Francisco also is in Missoula to assist the father and to pressure authorities to complete a thorough investigation into the shooting. She says local law enforcement has been cooperative. Marcus Karma is charged with deliberate homicide in an early Sunday shooting of Diren Didi. Prosecutors allege Karma shot into the garage without a warning after an intruder tripped sensors he had installed. Reinhardt says the consulate considers the shooting to be, quote, completely out of proportion to the risk Karma faced.
University of Montana journalism professor and German native Henrietta Lewisch has been filing stories about the shooting with a Berlin daily newspaper and her previous employer, the international news service Agence France Presse. Lewisch says Germans are shocked but not surprised by the shooting. She says Germans already think of Americans as, quote, trigger happy.
Majority of Germans don't own guns. They would never, consider using a gun to protect themselves. It's not something people do in Germany. So this situation is not one, where a citizen tries to protect his home with a shotgun is not something that would be conceivable in Germany, I would say.
Lewisch says the shooting is having repercussions far beyond the personal tragedy for the families involved.
The mayor of Hamburg, where the boy came from, has already spoken to the press, you know, expressed great regret that this happened, and dismay. The prosecution in Germany, the prosecutor's office in Hamburg, has already asked, you know, the county attorney here for information, and they are starting an investigation in this.
Lois herself has hosted a German exchange student in the past and has strong feelings about the shooting.
I think I'm aghast of that this can have happened. I still want to know exactly what happened. Why did he go into this garage? I really, really feel with the host family. I mean, that must be horrible to have a child, a host child, and then that child gets killed. I don't think this needed to happen.
Democratic State Representative Ellie Hill says Sunday's shooting is a prime example of why she believes Montana's Castle Doctrine is a terrible legislation. The former prosecuting attorney has introduced a draft bill to be considered by the 2015 legislature that would revise the measure. Hill described Sunday's shooting of Darren Deedy as, quote, appalling.
And I've been appalled since I heard that the 2009 session had enacted these expansions of our self-defense. It's in 24 states in this country, and whether it's been Trayvon Martin or what's occurred up in Kalispell or what happened this last weekend in Montana, I think that the culture was there for this to happen, and I think it's time that we fight back and do something about it.
Hill says the Montana legislature's 2009 version of the Castle Doctrine was fixing a problem that didn't exist.
We've had 100 years of a history in this state and in this nation of perfectly fine self-defense laws, including that if someone broke in your house, you know, that you had the ability to use lethal force if you were in danger. But that's not what the Castle Doctrine is. And it allows you to use lethal force in a much expanded situations. And we just need to stand up to the National Rifle Association and say we don't need these laws in our states, that it's not an attack on the Second Amendment to say that.
Montana Shooting Sports Association President Gary Marbot says he doesn't think Hill fully understands if Montana's gun laws are sufficient or insufficient. He says he believes they work quite well as written.
Montana's Castle Doctrine has probably been in Montana statute since territorial days, the Bannock statutes. We call it not Castle Doctrine, but Defense of an Occupied Structure. And that's been in Montana for a long time. It's proven and tried and has worked well for us for well over a century.
Marbot adds House Bill 228 changed several aspects of self-defense-related law, but did not change underlying principles. For example, he says it required police to collect all the evidence at the scene of the shooting, including evidence that could exonerate someone accused of firing a weapon in self-defense.
I mean, it required police not to destroy guns. It clarified what has been the case in case law for a century in Montana, and that is that open carry is legal. I mean, it clarified the defensive display of a firearm is legal because we think it's better to make a bad guy go away by saying, I have a gun and I will defend myself, than to have to shoot the bad guy. So it made a bunch of changes in Montana law, but none of the changes that Representative Hill seems to be concerned about.
Marbot predicts Hill's proposed bill will go nowhere if successfully introduced to the legislature. Hill expects resistance, in particular from the NRA, but adds she's already hearing from Montanans who believe something needs to be done to curtail gun violence.
A former Jefferson County jailer has denied charges that he exchanged cigarettes for sex with three female inmates. The Montana Standard reports 45-year-old Rodney Mortimer pleaded not guilty to 7 counts of sexual intercourse without consent during a district court hearing in Boulder. Mortimer was arrested on April 12th. The same day, a 19-year-old woman filed a complaint alleging she received cigarettes from Mortimer in exchange for sex over a period of several months. Court records say Mortimer acknowledged having sex with the woman and said he brought cigarettes to other inmates. Two other women told investigators that they received cigarettes from Mortimer in exchange for sex. Under state law, inmates cannot legally consent to sex.
An Occupational Safety and Health Administration official says the death of an oil worker in North Dakota is being investigated. Eric Brooks with the agency's office in Bismarck says Black Gold testing employee Zach Buckles was found unresponsive on a well pad site around 5 miles south of Williston on Monday. The 20-year-old man is from Glasgow, Montana. The death occurred on a Continental Resources site where Black Gold testing is working as a contractor. Brooks says about half of workplace fatalities investigated by his office involved the state's booming oil industry. North Dakota had the highest workplace fatality rate in the nation in 2011, according to a report released by the AFL-CIO. The report shows there are 12.4 fatalities per 100,000 employees in the state that year.
He's been called, quote, the country's most influential conservative Christian thinker, and he'll be speaking in Missoula this week as part of the President's Lecture Series at the University of Montana. Robert P. George is a Princeton University professor, author, and chairman of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. He's also past chairman of the National Organization for Marriage, one of the groups opposing the legalization of same-sex marriage. In this feature interview, George talks with news director Sally Mock about recent legal cases charging violation of religious freedom, like the one challenging the Affordable Care Act's requirement that employers provide their workers insurance coverage for contraception and abortion-inducing drugs.
And the first case has already been heard by the Supreme Court of the United States very recently. It's the Hobby Lobby case in which the Green families, who are the principal owners of the Hobby Lobby chain, are challenging the mandates on the grounds that they violate the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. That was a piece of federal legislation put into place in the early to mid-1990s in the aftermath of a very controversial Supreme Court decision called Employment Division against Smith coming up out of Oregon, in which the court essentially did away with what at that point had been the traditional standards of constitutional review for religious liberty claims, and that is the standard that says when a law or executive action impinges negatively on someone's religious freedom, the government has the obligation to show that the law is necessary and is narrowly tailored to advance a compelling state interest. That's the highest standard known in our law, and in the absence of such a showing, the claimant must be given a conduct exemption from the law in question. When the court essentially abandoned that standard, Congress, by overwhelming bipartisan majorities in both houses, enacted the Religious Freedom Restoration Act to restore the standard, and President Clinton signed it into law. So it is pursuant to that law, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which is known as RFRA, and the standard that it reestablishes that that the court's going to be deciding the Hobby Lobby case.
And you would agree with the Hobby Lobby folks that it is a violation of religious freedom if they are compelled, being opposed to abortion, to, for example, provide payment for that to an employee.
Yeah, the government's got to meet the standard, and it's hard for me, having read the transcript of the oral argument before the Supreme Court, it's hard for me to see how the government can meet the burden there, and that's in part, as a couple of the justices pointed out, because the Obama administration has granted waivers generally to businesses and unions and others from the requirements of the Affordable Care Act. And if the waivers can be granted for non-religious freedom-based reasons, it's hard to see how they could then constitute, nevertheless, a compelling state interest, and it's hard for the state to make out that argument, the state here being the government, the federal government in this case.
And of course, the other debate about religious freedom currently in this country hinges in part on if someone has to serve a gay person in their business and they believe that that violates their religious tenets, then they would rather not do that.
I think that the real cases that arise have mainly to do with whether a claimant who cannot in conscience participate in, by contributing services to, or professional artistic talents to, a same-sex blessing ceremony or wedding ceremony can nevertheless be compelled by the coercive power of the state to participate in that way. So I don't think that the standard cases, at least the cases I'm familiar with, don't involve someone walking into a business and ordering an ice cream cone and being told, well, we can't serve you.
And do you agree that that's a violation of religious freedom?
I agree that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act should apply there just as it applies everywhere else. Now, in any particular case, the application of the act, the consequences of applying the act, will depend on some contingent circumstances. whether, in fact, there is a compelling state interest. Some of the considerations that will be taken into account, for example, will be whether people seeking to have their event served have the effective alternative of other providers. If they don't, then the case for rejecting the religious freedom claim is going to be stronger than if they do.
At what point, Dr. George, do civil rights trump religious freedom, if ever? The usual example is, for example, if a person says their religious beliefs include white supremacy or white separatism and they don't want to serve black people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the standard is clear. It's a compelling state interest and least restrictive or intrusive means of prosecuting that interest, and that would apply under RFRA in all cases. And I think that the compelling state interest in ending racial discrimination, where what you had was a system, a comprehensive system of racial subordination and exploitation, reducing an entire race of people to a condition of servitude, a race of people who had previously been under official servitude in a system of slavery. That's a very powerful consideration. So I don't think that religious freedom considerations are going to weigh very heavily when it comes to racial discrimination or something similar to that.
Mm-hmm. But you would argue that there's not the same compelling state interest for someone's sexual orientation.
Well, I think what you have in the case of the nature of marriage and sexual ethics is a reasonable debate in this country among people of goodwill, and I think it's wrong for anybody on any side to deny that. Nobody on either side is the equivalent of a bigot or a racist or a hater. We should stop calling each other names or assuming that there's no reasonable argument on one side or the other. There are some cases, like racial discrimination, which are straight out pure, unambiguous bigotry. There are other issues on which reasonable people of goodwill can and do disagree. So I don't think we should analogize our differences with our fellow citizens over a vast range of things, including the nature of marriage and the requirements of sexual morality, to racial bigotry. And I stress again, it shouldn't be done on either side. I also think that no one should be, for example, fired from a job for any advocacy on either side by anyone of an issue like this on which reasonable people of goodwill can and do disagree.
I mean, I could just interrupt, because I want to clarify for our listeners your position. If there is a business person who says, I'm not going to serve black people, you would find that compelling state interest would say they should not practice that. But if someone who owned a business said, I do not want to serve a gay couple, that would be, in your mind, not a compelling state interest that they should do that.
Let's be clear on what we're talking about here. It's not a question of whether someone who comes into a shop should be served, whether they are same-sex partners or whether they are people who oppose same-sex relationships. The real question is, can someone be compelled with the force of law to participate in an event to which they have reasonable moral objections, like a wedding or some other kind of a ceremony?
Okay, well, let's use that example. So if a wedding photographer said, I'm not going to take photographs of a wedding between an African-American couple, you would say the compelling state interest is they should be compelled to do that. But if it was a gay couple, you would say not.
I don't think that you can draw an analogy between the debate over marriage and sexual relationships and the question of racial bigotry. I do not think that they're equivalent. That's correct.
Let's do now talk about your position on gay marriage.
It's not what I'm coming to Montana to talk about, of course. I'm coming to Montana to talk about religious freedom. Now, I'm happy to talk about marriage if that's what you want to talk about, but it's actually not what I'm in Montana to talk about.
I would like to talk about it. I think it's of interest to our listeners, don't you?
I suspect it's an NPR station, isn't it?
Yep, I think it'd be of interest to anyone. I mean, it's a current huge debate, certainly. In your position, Dr. George, is that marriage is only between a man and a woman?
One of each.
You have been quoted as saying that legalizing same-sex marriage would be a disaster for children.
I think what is a disaster for children is transforming marriage, and this transformation began in the 1960s. Transforming marriage from a conjugal partnership to a form of romantic companionship or domestic partnership in which the having and rearing of children is merely incidental, where the real nature of the relationship being recognized has to do with affection, emotion, the romantic bond. I don't think the state has any particular interest in our romantic bonds just as such, any more than it has any interest in our ordinary friendships. What it has an interest in is an institution which historically, and I think rightly, has been understood as one that brings together a man and woman as husband and wife to be father and mother to children who are born of that union, giving to offspring the advantage of being brought up in the marital bond, the committed bond of mother and father, the mother and father whose union brought them into being. Now, of course, things happen. Not everything goes well. Families break down. People die. Parents die. Arrangements have to be made where the best interest of children is the fundamental concern. But the institution of marriage, historically and I think correctly, has as its ground of legal recognition its importance in bonding parents to their children and giving children the advantage of, to the extent possible, whenever possible, in the maximum number of cases, being brought up in the bond of the mother and father that whose union brought them into being.
So a couple, a man and a woman, who did not want to have children but wanted to be legally married, you would say the state has no interest in that marriage either?
The state has an interest in the institution of marriage. The state has an interest in the institution of marriage. But insofar as their bond is merely a romantic bond, it doesn't have an interest in the bond. It does have an interest in the institution.
I just have time for one final question for you, Dr. George, and this is a little bit off topic, but not totally. And that is, what do you think of Pope Francis, who appears to be trying to steer Catholics like yourself away from focusing on issues like gay marriage and abortion and back to social justice issues like helping the poor? What do you think of him and his sort of admonitions about that recently?
Gosh, I think Pope Francis is wonderful, and I love his focus on social justice and helping the poor. And I agree with him that among the central issues of social justice are issues of the sanctity of human life and the dignity of marriage as the conjugal union of husband and wife that is the greatest anti-poverty program that's ever been created. The Pope has in no way backed away either from his convictions or the Church's teachings on the sanctity of life or on the dignity and nature of marriage. So I say amen, brother. I'm with him 100%. I think he's offering great leadership here, and everybody on the left and on the right should listen to both sides of what he says. Nothing would please me more than if my friends on the left as well as my friends on the right would perceive the wisdom in what Pope Francis is saying and embrace his positions wholeheartedly.
Well, I've been speaking with Princeton University professor and author Robert P. George. Dr. George, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Robert P. George will give a free public lecture on the nature and scope of religious freedom tomorrow evening at 8 o'clock in the University Center Ballroom on the University of Montana campus.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be mostly clear with lows in the 30s. Tomorrow, look for partly cloudy skies and highs in the 70s. For central Montana tonight, it should be mostly clear with lows 35 to 40 degrees. Tomorrow, look for partly cloudy skies and highs 65 to 75 degrees. And for southwest Montana tonight, expect mostly clear skies and lows in the 30s, and tomorrow should be sunny with highs 65 to 75 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Kelsey Stamm. Innovation. It is a concept that is promoted from the world of business and technology to education. Innovation is a word that is used so broadly and ascribed to so many things that its meaning has become vague at best or meaningless at worst. And what makes someone an innovator? Definitions vary from the first to introduce into reality something better than before,
or people who push boundaries of the known world, or simply change agents. These concepts, these people, often seem to be far away, people who are flown in for a two-hour lecture, or people you see on TED Talks. The truth is, you don't have to look that far to meet people who are pushing boundaries, people who are creating real and profound change. And it doesn't take a lot to contribute to innovations that make a real difference in your community and around the world. I would like to put a face to one of these innovators, a man named Payong. Payong, like many Thai and rural communities, was born into a farming family. Payong knew how farmers were caught in a cycle of debt, and when prices dropped too low, Payong and his brothers had to work as sharecroppers just to feed the family. Like many youth, Payong left the farm. He became trained as a political scientist at one of the most prestigious universities in Bangkok and was poised for a fruitful career in business or law. But Payong never forgot what the hardships of farmers were like, and he returned to his family's farm to teach organic agriculture to small farmers. This approach would both help conserve Thailand's natural resources and provide farmers with a higher and more sustainable income. Today, Payong works at refugee camps along the Thai-Burma border, teaching sustainable farming to the Karen ethnic minority. Payong is one of dozens of innovators who has come to Montana as a participant in the State Department's Professional Fellows Program, managed by the Mansfield Center at the University of Montana. While in Montana, Payong was partnered with another innovator, Josh Slotnick of Garden City Harvest. Together, they are blazing a path to connect American and Thai students and inspire a new generation to lead the movement for sustainable agriculture. Phuong is an example of a person who is breaking new ground in her country of Vietnam. Phuong was born without the use of her right leg. Despite an increase of several hundred thousand children who were born with disabilities as a result of the Vietnam War, Vietnam does not have the infrastructure to accommodate people with disabilities. It is expected that children with physical or developmental disabilities be kept at home. Phuong's parents decided that their daughter would have a different future and sent her to school. Phuong describes the challenges of maneuvering the city on crutches, saying, "In elementary school, I had to climb one flight of stairs to get to class. In high school, there were two flights of stairs. And in college, I had to climb three flights of stairs every day." But Phuong never stopped, and she went on to earn two university degrees. Based on her time in Montana, Phuong has adapted the YWCA's Secret Seconds thrift store model to open the very first thrift store in Vietnam, the proceeds of which will benefit people with disabilities. We look forward to welcoming our next group of Southeast Asian fellows who arrive in May. One of these fellows is a Cambodian social entrepreneur who is expanding his tourism business to train local people to keep tourism dollars within the local economy. Another is one of the few female tech entrepreneurs from Burma who launched a business that is now part of one of the largest software development companies in her country. And there is a social worker from Thailand who is starting a business training program for orphan girls, many of them who have HIV. The Mansfield Center is proud to bring leaders together from around the world here in Montana. While we carry on Senator Mansfield's legacy of promoting U.S.-Asia relations and ethics in public affairs and leadership, we also look to the future. Partnering passionate and courageous leaders from the East and the West can result in meaningful change that truly impacts lives. Building these bridges is part of the mission of the Mansfield Center, and we invite you to join us. You can visit our website at www.umt.edu/Mansfield to learn more. On behalf of the Maureen and Mike Mansfield Center, I am Kelsey Stamm. Thank you for listening.
Kelsey Stamm is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.